Welcome and welcome back, talkers, to another episode of Talks with Trishani, where we talk the talk and controversy is our main dish. In our last episode, you got to learn a little about us and, of course, what this podcast will be about. But now it's time to delve into the meat of the matter and really get to talking. This episode will be discussing euthanasia and moral subjectivity in a three-part series that we promise will not only be interesting, but informative and, of course, thought-provoking. If you're not really sure what euthanasia is, keep listening to find out. In the meantime, be sure to follow and engage us on Instagram by clicking the link in our description and showing love to our pod by faving, following and subscribing if you're listening on Anchor, Spotify or Apple Podcasts, respectively. And of course, share, and share one more time because you don't want to keep all this good stuff to yourself. With all of that being said, Trish, let's talk to the people. What is euthanasia?
Good morning, good evening, good night to all of our listeners. Euthanasia has Greek origin and it basically means the good death. And it is the act of killing an incurable ill person out of concern and compassion for that person suffering.
What does all of this have to do with moral subjectivity, and what even is moral subjectivity in the first place? So moral subjectivity is basically the claim that our morals are all human made and can vary from person to person. There are, however, morals that have strong hold over society or humanity, allowing us to collectively agree that acts such as killing or stealing are essentially wrong. However, as humans, we are unique, and even as cultures, we are unique. We have beliefs and principles we uphold that may not be the same as the next person or even the next culture. And this is evident through the present comparison, or the ever-present comparison of Western culture versus Eastern culture, where things that are morally correct in the West aren't in the East, and of course, vice versa. So when we're looking at the subjectivity and sometimes the objectivity of morality, we have to consider if our morality is solely based on what we're taught, or is there something deeper driving us to do the perceived good? If we were taught that it was okay to kill and steal and, you know, all of that, would it then be okay?
Is there a gray area between I want to hurt you to not hurt you? You know what I'm saying? And that is what we're going to really talk about on the topic of euthanasia. And this is very hush-hush in many societies and cultures because no one really likes to talk about killing someone for the quote-unquote greater good.
Right. And with moral subjectivity, based on that, does killing then become good based on our individual morality? That's a big question.
Mm-hmm. And it also varies from situation to situation, because I can think that if you killed my mother, I should take revenge and that would make me good because I'm avenging her. But the person I'm going to kill or kill while I'm trying to avenge my mother probably did not do anything, and in your eyes that would be immoral. In my eyes, that would just be collateral damage.
Yeah.
So we're going to speak on all of that today. And I have an example of euthanasia, and we can talk about the gray area between what is morally correct and what is morally wrong. So an example of this is on September 17, 1999, Dr. Jack Kevorkian videotaped himself administering a lethal medication to Thomas Yuck, a 52-year-old Michigan man with amyotrophic lateral sclerosis. And authorities subsequently charged Dr. Jack with first-degree premeditated murder, crime assistance of a suicide, and delivery of a controlled substance for administering lethal medication to a terminally ill man. Now, there was no dispute that the dose administered was at the request of Mr. Yuck, which is the patient, nor was there any dispute that Mr. Yuck was terminally ill. A jury found Dr. Jack guilty of second-degree murder in 1999, and he was sent to prison. So that really begs the question, what Dr. Jack did, was it morally correct? Because he was trying to end the pain and suffering of of Thomas. So, what were your thoughts? Do you think it was morally incorrect of him?
When we're looking at the morally incorrect part, how morally incorrect it is, we have to look at morally incorrect to who. And it all comes back down to moral subjectivity, because to me, honestly, you're taking a man out of his suffering.
Right.
Why prolong his suffering when he has already accepted death and even requested it? Why do we perceive this as wrong if, well, judging by murder, by society's standards, because society views murder as just murder, as just killing. It's wrong in all aspects of the word. But we have to look at if there are certain exceptions. Because if I am terminally ill, I know I'm going to die anyways, why would I want to prolong my suffering?
Right. And as I was saying, there's that gray area that moral subjectivity is really up to individual perspective. And that is where many people have some disconnect in conversation and in making the big decision and in having the hard conversations, because the doctor and the patient can see that, yes, he was in suffering, I was in suffering, and it was just better for me to end this now. But someone on the outside looking in might say, why are you speeding up death? Who are you to speed up death? Are you God? Are you a deity? If you did not breathe life into this man, you have no right to end his life.
We have to look at another perspective, whereas if a man is in control of how he lives his life and he reaches a point where he thinks that he cannot go on, who are we to subject him to that type of suffering when he has requested to just end it all? Why do we think we are at liberty to dictate the pain that he should undergo for the remainder of his life solely because we think that, life and death shouldn't be in our hands?
Right, and that also begs the question, do individuals have a right to choose when and how they die? But before we talk about that, I'm not sure if our listeners know, but there is not one clear-cut type of euthanasia. There are actually about four types. So you have passive euthanasia, active euthanasia, physician-associated suicide, and involuntary euthanasia. So, passive euthanasia is the hastening of one's death by altering some form of support. This is, for example, giving a patient high doses of morphine to control pain or the failure to resuscitate. Those are examples that are performed on terminally ill and suffering persons so that natural death will occur sooner, and they are commonly performed on persons in a persistent vegetative state. So massive brain damage or spinal injury, that has to do with passive euthanasia. Then you have active euthanasia, which is far more controversial, and this involves causing death through direct action in response to a request from that person. This is the important part. It is in response to a person's request. So this is lethal injection, and this is very controversial, because lethal injections are used to kill or execute prisoners, and having to use that method to hasten death, it is a very touchy subject, right? And another form of active euthanasia would be to restrict care or restrict support. So doing my research, I found out that doctors, physicians can not feed their patients, cannot give them water so that the course will take on fast or the course of death. In many jurisdictions, active euthanasia can be considered as manslaughter or murder, where passive euthanasia is accepted by some medical professional societies and by law under certain circumstances. And we know...
I can understand why.
Yeah, because...
passive is more acceptable. Because while the passive takes them out of their suffering quicker, the active seems to be prolonging it.
Yes, and it also appeals to people's pathos because it's like you're giving them a lot of support at one time. So nothing is being injected or anything like that. It's just a lot of support, you know, over support, which leads them on to their death. The next one is physician-assisted suicide. And this is somewhat of a hybrid between passive and active, and it is also known as voluntary passive euthanasia. And in this situation, the physician supplies information and or the means of committing suicide by a lethal dose of sleeping pills or a supply of carbon monoxide so that the person can terminate their own life. And this is the method of euthanasia that Dr. Jack, that we spoke on earlier, chose to use. And we see that it is really not legal and it is not accepted in many parts. And the final we're going to talk about is involuntary euthanasia, which is the killing of a person who has not explicitly requested aid in dying. Now, this is used in respect to patients who are in a persistent vegetative state and who will probably, and this is the key word, probably never recover from consciousness. And in involuntary euthanasia, it is usually the caretakers, the family members that choose when the patient dies. And my thing with this, the question I would like to bring is, what makes a family member, a caretaker, your spouse, your sibling, what gives them the right, or do they have the right, in the case that you're in a vegetative state, do they possess the right to say when you die?
This is very controversial, because you might have the same persons who think that somebody should request for themselves to be euthanized, but then we'll turn around and agree that in the event that someone is vegetated or cannot respond, a family member or caretaker can or have the power to request euthanasia. Yeah. So how different is it from if I know that I'm terminally ill and I say, okay, me go dead anyway, so guess what?
In the event,
me go dead in like 3 months. Just
right.
Just drugs me up and let me go.
Right.
How different is that from someone who is in a coma, for example, and their mother, sister, father, daughter say, okay, doesn't look like they're gonna wake up. They've been here for a while.
Let them go.
Do your thing. Let them go.
Right. But you know what the issue is here is that many times this is not a conversation that is held in the home. That is the first issue, because persons love to shy away from hard topics. No one wants to say in the event that. And another thing is that persons don't usually find themselves in position in like a vegetative state where they can say, okay, in the next few months, I'm going to be in a state where I cannot talk or communicate. And in the event, do that. It's usually things that happen like this, rash decisions. So for instance, a car crash or a bad fall or something happened at the workplace, or even an earthquake and, you know, debris falling or a tornado. It's usually disasters that no one could ever think of and say in the event of. So that is really something to know. Conversation or previous conversation was had, you know. How does my closeness to somebody allow them to decide when I die?
On that, to add to your point about persons shying away from conversation like this, I think the problem with that is no one wants their morality to be questioned. Ooh. And this is where moral subjectivity comes into play again, because most of the times we are of the view that, okay, the moral standards of society has to necessarily align with our personal moral standing, and that doesn't have to be the case. No matter how right it seems. For example, the law in Jamaica where states that boys or men who are raped by other men, the victim can be charged for buggery. Me as a person, me can't agree with that law, no matter how it look like, say that is a standard and that me must agree to. I can't agree to that, because a victim is a victim regardless. So I think that persons are scared to have their morality questioned and held or scrutinized in comparison to the general moral society.
And I do think that many institutions, not only in Jamaica or in the Western world versus the Eastern world, but many institutions facilitate this type of thinking because they don't allow the rules to be, they're very clear-cut rules, and they don't account for that gray area, because euthanasia really is a gray area and it is seen by the different types. And with the same example that you have given, where is that gray area? Because victim blaming, you can never blame a victim because of the circumstances. And I do feel like many institutions facilitate this by not having circumstantial rules. You get me? Which would account for certain situations. So I do feel like that contributes to the issue as well.
You have just heard part one of the euthanasia series. Interested in listening more? Click on our profile to pick up where we left off in part two. See you there!